Hello and welcome to Intertextual Experience, where we're excited to talk travel games with our 38th guest, Mr. Ben of travelgames.co.uk. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Well, fairly busy day as normal, packing lots of boxes, translating lots of stuff. That's about it, really. Yeah. How about you?
That's good. I think I have a busy day ahead of me. It's well, just got up. We have a little bit of a time difference. It always makes for like a funny intro. It's like, oh, good morning. I mean, afternoon, but I am kind of just returning from my first Gen Con, so I've been making to-do lists. I didn't actually really make a to-do list. Yesterday was a catch-up day slash kind of relaxed day. And then I just sat on my phone and I think I had like 25 different things. I was like, do this, do this, do this. And I was like, okay, I'm going to bed before I add more to
You're doing better than me after a convention. A big
it.
convention usually wipes me out for about a week, so.
Yeah, I think this go get after it attitude is just more so out of necessity, not out of like just my general disposition. So okay, I'll show you. This is always fun because we have an audio only podcast, but the you and me, we always get the video, and this kind of ties into everything. And honestly, for the sake of this show, I might show notes or something. Maybe I'll do pictures document of the things in there. Here's a box.
Okay.
Some may call it a mystery box.
Oh, okay.
But I'm just going to ask you my now sometimes opening question with a slight variation, and then we'll get here. And that is, what's a formative gaming memory, and how do you feel that your gaming has led you into creating travel games, which very excitingly has branched into different, like, so sorry, as an online retailer, into designs and publications, re-implementations, and kind of like more and more. But we'll get to a lot of that other stuff in a bit. But again, kind of that formative gaming memory, and then how do you feel that that has led you to the start of creating travel games?
That's an interesting one because the formative game memory is going to be a big crunchy game, and the games that I sell at Travel Games are kind of the opposite. But so my first kind of introduction into hobby board games was Agricola or whatever you want to call it. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. Played it with some friends, made a nice farm, all that kind of thing. It was a bit crunchy, but we immediately got home and bought a copy and then played it quite a lot. And then the collection grows as it does. And then the collection gets too big and you start buying small games to fit in the gaps. So that's kind of maybe where it started. We set up a board game group at the university for the staff and for the postgraduates. And I somehow ended up being the rules teaching person. And I very quickly found that if you're taking big crunchy games all the time, you've got to keep all these big crunchy games in your head. And also you've got to teach it at the beginning of each session, which is going to take up a good half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever it takes. So gradually I started like shrinking the games down. And then I found trick taking out of it's less load on my brain to be able to teach trick taking games because once everyone's got the basic vocab for it, you can go, it's this, 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 and this with this twist. And at that point, you kind of step back from being a rules teacher a little bit and you can just play the games a lot quicker. So that's kind of how I got into the small box trick taking type thing. And then the importing thing, I started import. So my wife speaks better Japanese than me. I spoke none when we started going out, and she's just taught me stuff as we've been driving around in the car and that kind of stuff. We started off playing things like Lost Cities, but in Japanese, so I could learn colors and numbers and things like that. So you play the card, say the color, say the number. And then for her birthday one year, I imported a couple of board games over from Japan. Didn't do it very well, got charged loads of fees. But then we found like there's another kind of smaller section of board games that were a bit more niche, and I could practice a bit of Japanese with it. And yeah, it was just interesting. So that's when I started importing stuff, really.
Oh, very, very cool. So yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah, I don't know. That definitely answers my question. And furthermore, just kind of thinking about the idea of importing too, like I haven't really gone through the process of trying to like import the games, which is why sites like Travel Games and other ones and you know other places. It is such a nice tool and such a nice resource to be able to like, it's like, oh, here's a game that I'm looking for. Someone else
And
has done the work.
yeah, it's that Russian roulette of like what fees are going to land on this one game that I've ordered.
Yep.
Yeah, there was one called Vughex, which I ordered in very early on, one copy, and it's 18 cards. And I think it came to about 60, £70. And at that point, you're like, I did this wrong. But yeah, it's just things like one little slip up on a form, and suddenly you've got a bill coming through that you weren't expecting. So it is nice to offer something where people can put it in their cart, buy it, and they know what they're paying.
Yeah, that's definitely appreciated by people like me who, in terms of forms or slip ups or whatever it might be, I would definitely make many of them. Okay, so I showed you this box and yeah, I it's weird because I was like, oh, I have follow up questions to your thought, but I'm like, okay, the follow up questions, they all exist in the box in some capacity, so I didn't want to like jump into it too much, but if I'm not mistaken, well, I don't think I'm mistaken, through Travel Games, you have set up these Tokyo Game Market mystery boxes, and I was in on the first round of that. In the box, there will be questions about the Tokyo Game Market mystery boxes, so you could explain it more whenever we find the correct item. Which, first off, okay, here's like my little anecdote before having you talk, which is what people are here for. But I actually, okay, so I don't do, or at least for the show or anything board game related, I haven't done anything like video yet, really. I kind of want to, that's a whole different story. But one of the things I wanted to do was do an unboxing of my TGM mystery box. So I had it all set up. I was like recording. I was kind of talking about the games that I was getting, which a lot of like was, you know, saw or was unfamiliar with, but everything was very cool. Like the presentation of this box was amazing. So the video was neat because you could see all these like nice personal touches, pictures, just like little toys and, you know, pencils. I actually think I have like one of the pencils here. Like I said,
oh, those little green pegsels.
Yeah. Oh, I have one literally right here. I use it to write a lot of my notes. If I have to do a paper note. So yeah, it was just really well put together. You'd written a very kind handwritten note. This box is not packed with as much care, but basically I wanted that to be like my first video. It was cute. My cat was like climbing all in and out all my stuff. And then I don't even know, maybe midway through me just like rambling and all that, my phone stopped recording. So I go get my phone. It's like, oh, video stopped recording because you ran out of space. I was like, what the? So the video kind of exists, but it never really existed. It was off-putting. So, well, that's the thing.
Fair enough.
But yeah, they're very, very cool.
Yeah, I get quite a few of those videos now. Like the first wave, I didn't really get any, but the second wave, I got quite a few of those videos. It's really nice to watch like them being opened from the other side.
Yeah,
because I'm there making like it's basically like some big maths puzzle where you're trying to work out like, well, that person's got that game and that game and that game. That person's got that game, so they can't have it, but they can have that. And you're like, yeah, jumble it all around. So for me, it's like a big puzzle. But then if you watch it from the other side, it's just like a nice unboxing of things that they don't necessarily know what everything is yet. But it's just nice to get people's kind of first reactions with it.
Yeah, well, I guess even more so now. I'm sorry that you didn't get to see mine. If only because you didn't get to see my cat enjoying all the gifts too. But
Well, I get lots of messages from people with cats that are like, all the stickers that you send, they're all under my sofa somewhere because the cat steals them and like bats them under the sofa.
that's fair. I hope my cat didn't steal because actually, well, where I'm sitting across from a closet that has some shelves in it, and I think I know literally where all the stickers from this still are, so who knows though. They are quite mischievous and they take stuff without you knowing, so all right, so I'll see you. Oh, this isn't going to be good for audio. I'm pulling tape off a box. I actually put tape on the box, so that's some dedication. Okay, maybe I should have not done the tape, but okay, let's see if I can make this box or the contents of this box. Oh,
I can
yeah,
see
there.
a red thing wrapped up and a blue thing wrapped up, and a pink thing.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah,
So
there's.
there's stuff in there. Which looks most enticing? Because whatever you pick, I'll unwrap and it's linked to a question.
I'm going to go for the lime green one at the back
Ooh, the
because
lime.
that's one of my favorite colors.
Nice. Okay, so there's only, yeah, that's good. There's only one lime green object in here, so
The color of my living room.
That's funny. Okay, this is a copy of the novel White Noise by Don DeLillo.
Okay.
It's one of my favorites. So, when we were, chatting and kind of talking about talking, I just it kind of went based on some of the things you said interested you, and then I came up with questions based on it. So
Fair
this
enough.
one has a few questions linked to it. Oh, and yeah, I had that anecdote about my video cutting off too, and that was because there are a bunch of things in this box, and each thing has at least a question. So, with that said, just so you know, if it feels like we've opened like three or four items and it's already been like an hour or something, you can be like, okay, pump the brakes. We can cut it just like the video. I just
Just mid-word.
mid-word. I overplan these interviews, which I think is good because it leaves potential future conversations, and it's, yeah, okay, it's just like the way I do it. That's the way my brain works. But with White Noise novel, I think all the questions were actually going to make sense. First off, is there like a book or a couple of books that you are currently reading?
So I'm just reading or finishing up the follow-up from A Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches, which was my favorite book of last year. This one is something to do with magical innkeeping. Problem is, if I read on a Kindle, you don't get to see the cover anymore,
Yep.
and you're like, I'm reading a thing, but I don't know what it's called. But it's by Sangu Mandana, I think. Kind of witches and things, but in a normal world setting. Characters are always funny, and like the characters hold it all together. It's not like high action or anything like that. But it draws you in really well. Has a nice kind of sense of where it is as well. I think most of them are based kind of the first one was based in around Norwich and the eastern side of the UK, and then this one's a bit more kind of Peak District way, I think, off the top of my head. And it also has a zombie chicken in it. So, you know, what could go wrong there?
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Oh, neat. Yeah, I always like hearing what people are reading. Just keep adding to my list, which will never be caught up to, but
Yeah, I'm also, well, more listening, but still books and short stories. A lot of Japanese kind of folk tales and yokai stories, which came off the back of a game I'm designing for next. No, the Spring Tokyo Game Market, because the next one hasn't happened just yet.
yeah.
So I fell down a bit of a rabbit hole, wrote some short stories for the game. And then, yeah, I've just kept on going from there. So,
Which one is that for? Because I've have your kind of upcoming games pulled up. That is going to be
So that's
for.
for After You, Better San. So Better San is like a giant round ghost blob with legs, wearing some Getter sandals, and he kind of has a big grin, doesn't have any eyes, follows you around and stomps at the same kind of pace as your footprints, and just creeps you out a little bit. You think someone's following you, and the only way you can get rid of him is to step aside and go, "After you, Better San," and it'll just nod at you and walk away. But he's not harmful, he just drives you a little bit mad, which I think is quite nice. So yeah, I made a little story up about that, which I'm going to put in the box, I think. So
Like that. And for what it's worth, I was kind of asking that question before I clicked on the page. If I were to look at the titles and guess which one you're talking about based on what you said you were listening to, that's the one I would have picked. But nonetheless.
Oh, there's a few I need to add on yet. Yeah, a bit of a
Oh.
creative spurt in the last couple of weeks. So.
That's awesome. And actually, believe it or not, there is a set of question that's linked to that too. So that's good. But
Yep.
no, that I like how that one tied in. Okay, we're on books, and I have two more questions for this one. They don't all have like multiple, though. They
Yeah.
all have at least one, though. Okay, which like book or series or anything in that written fiction verse, have you seen that you feel is best adapted or represented in a board game?
Yeah, I'm definitely a bit biased on this one. So, my wife was a massive Terry Pratchett fan, is a massive Terry Pratchett fan. And I started reading it before we were going out and enjoying them. But before we got engaged, we were signed up to a Terry Pratchett convention. We got married, and 2 days after we got married, we went to the board game, the Terry Pratchett convention on our honeymoon in central Birmingham. So, which is, yeah. But one of the very early board games we bought after we bought Agricola was Discworld Ankh-Morpork, which is sounds terrible if you describe it, but it pulls several terrible things together and makes something excellent. Because it's a kind of a mix of Monopoly, which everyone's going to go, boo, Monopoly. Then it's a mix of Cluedo, and it's also a mix of Risk. So, like, three very, like, supermarket board games.
Yeah.
They mash together really, really well. It's kind of a bit of area control. There's a little bit of chaos from the wizards. And then there's this social deduction bit in the background of trying to work out which character the other people are and what they're trying to do to win the game. And then stop them whilst trying to take over the right amount of areas for yourself. The other Discworld games, not so great. They're a bit bobbins. But fortunately, we landed on the good one first, and that kept kind of the interest going. And yeah, didn't stall our enthusiasm for board games. So.
Nice. That is funky. Like you said, kind of taking these three, huge mass market games and mishmash them all up. Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna look into that one a
Yeah,
bit.
it got redone because it went out of print and is now horrendously expensive. But they redid it as something called Nanty Narking, which is a bit more like kind of Charles Dickens themed. Still exactly the same game. They've just stuck different pictures over the top.
Yep.
But that still works equally as well. It's much, much cheaper.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if it's something that I'm like, oh, I should check that out, I'll probably go the cheaper route with no particular connection to either of the
Because
properties. So. Neat. Well, speaking of properties, so I showed you, well, I wrapped up a book, obviously talking about books and games and those connections, which is fun. But I kind of specifically picked White Noise because, well, when I was reading it, first off, I do actually have to reread it. I don't read a ton of books, but if I say it's one of my favorites and it's been like 10-ish years, and it's not going to take me a ton of time, unlike most everything else. I should reread it. But when I was reading it, I was like, wow, this is a really good novel. It feels very like bookish. You kind of create the world in your head and everything like that. But I would have never imagined that that thing was going to get turned into a movie or to get an adaptation. But I don't know what year, maybe 19 to 2020, it actually did get an adaptation. It was, I think, a Netflix release, and I haven't watched it, and I think that's going to be like a recurring thing, but it actually does wind up fitting well into some of maybe like the themes or ethos of this episode in a bit. And that's just kind of like breaking down barriers for others, kind of what Travel Games is doing, or even within yourself. I think sometimes people just need to do stuff and convince themselves to go for it. And I do want to watch that movie, but I think fear is holding me. But on the flip side, what's a favorite book to movie adaptation? Because I know that there's always some stickiness. Some people don't always have positive feelings.
That's a tricky one. That's a very tricky one. Trying to think. I'm actually struggling because I watch the movie, but I generally find the book is always going to be way better. I think it's because you get it stuck in your head of what the characters are, and as soon as something doesn't match that, it's kind of broken that part of it. Yeah, I'm actually really struggling with that. There's ones I've enjoyed. And actually it's not straight to movie, actually. I think book to theater I could tell you. Because we went to see Ocean at the End of the Lane, which unfortunately, yeah, Neil Gaiman's not in the best of books for being a bit of a nightmare. But this was before
Yes.
that, so anyway. But that was like I wondered how that would translate to the stage because it's very kind of Tim Burton-esque in how I would like visualize it in my head. And then how do you then compress that to a stage which doesn't have easily moving through lots of different scenes and that kind of thing. And it was done really, really well. Like it's one of the best theatre productions I've seen. Very dark, very purples and very blues. But like and the sets were very minimalist, but it conveyed the story very, very well. But again, there was one character that just didn't quite fit that kind of headcanon. And you as soon as they came on, you're like, no.
I do think I think the like at least a nice thing about like theater though too is if it like and I'm not sure if that's the case for this one, but like if there's something that winds up kind of keep getting like readapted and reinterpreted and things like that. It like you just keep kind of watching like more and more, and then you're able to kind of break some of that like initial headcanon, and that's kind of cool too. I mean, obviously movies get like remade a few times as well, but I think
Oh,
depending on.
there is actually one book series that was translated while thinking about it now. They just took me a little while to kind of carve my way through it. I'm going to have to think what on earth it was called. But essentially, it was the storyline's basically that kids can see ghosts, but adults can't, and you grow out of it. And it's all set in England. But the casting on that was perfect. I'm gonna have to look up what it is through my Audible things. But they have a glowing like skull in a bottle that just is incredibly sarcastic, just winds them up. But that follow there's only three like fairly short kind of teen level stories that it was written about, and they haven't deviated from them. They just compressed. So it's actually only two seasons, and then I think Netflix killed it before they could do the last season, but they did keep like a book a season and didn't really cut much out, so that worked really well. But I cannot for the life of me remember what it was called.
I guess that is kind of like a perk of a series too. You have a little bit more room to play, and especially if you're not taking something that's, let's see, was it? Oh,
It
sorry.
was Lockwood and Co.
Oh, okay.
So there's like the Empty Grave, the Creeping Shadow, and the Hollow Boy was were the books. And then yeah, each season was a book. I think they squished two books into one season as well because it was a mini one. But yeah, they did a good job for that.
Cool. Yeah, this looks to be well received. I didn't need the general population's opinions, just yours, but no,
Fair enough.
that's cool. Again, it's a perk and a danger. Just being introduced to like a whole bunch of things that people like, all right, we are on to, oh my goodness, this box.
I'm going to go for the red one because it seems to be like this one that fell over a second ago
Okay. Yeah, we'll grab
because it seems to be trying to get out, so we'll let it out.
Okay. We got two in red. They're both probably like the biggest items in here. So let's see which one this is. They're actually, I don't want to spoil it too much, both very similar in what they are, which is also kind of like, which one is this? Oh, okay. Whew, this is good. Actually ties into one of our more this is an unopened jar of better than bullion.
Okay.
So, for like
I think
soup.
it looked like mustard, but
Oh
it's
yeah.
not.
Yeah, it does, it definitely gives off mustard vibes. But like for like soups and
Like
stocks.
stock. Yeah.
Yeah, there. That thanks. You came up with it much better than I did. This one is kind of going to link then to something that we just mentioned, but specifically, this flavor is chicken. So the question line is going to be kind of diving into rotisserie chicken. You mentioned a bunch of games that are coming out from you and in a new design wave that hasn't even made it to your page yet. But that's kind of one of the things that I was noting and kind of mentioned a little bit before, but that's the fact that, Travel Games as an online board game retailer is like, branching out into like different publications, and technically there's a question coming up. I might just grab something from the box after this question. I'm cheating, and
That's fine.
I don't cheat. Like, I want the randomness. I'm here for the chaos, but it ties together. But nonetheless, designs, publications, and those publications could be re-implementations or just like, localizing to make them more available. You can talk about that because I know that you do different things, and I actually don't even know like the full extent without having a pretty decent idea. But I think that it's like interesting that, people who are interested in games and might go into one avenue, like I do this podcast, but I am also interested in design and just doing other things as well. But yeah, you surround yourself with board games. If you look around both of us, there are board games everywhere.
Well, this is the chaos shop. This
The
definitely isn't
chaos.
public consumption
Yeah,
because it was just utter chaos.
yeah. Well, the chaos here, oh my gosh. This is like an office. This is just like, this is not for any type of retail. This is for your eyes, technically only. But this is like what we're looking at behind me. Yeah, it's bad. Okay. But yeah, half of the games are on the floor right now. Anyway. Yeah, so we like literally are surrounded by board games and, are engaging with or game media and are thinking about it. So I think like, yeah, it's very natural to want to keep doing more. That's kind of like the way I think about it. It's like, yeah, why wouldn't you? But I guess then the question for you is, with a bunch of designs slated for you in the near future, things that you're working on, like, when would you say you knew you wanted to design? Are there any of the designs? Because I think, if I'm not mistaken, Rotisserie Chicken was kind of like the first announced.
It was the first announced, yeah. It was
Yeah.
the second design.
Okay.
It's yeah. So, but I didn't. I've tried to make games in the past and never really got anywhere with it. But I then left it alone for a good few years, set up the shop. I've been doing that kind of thing. And I think the big thing that's changed is the sheer amount of rules that I translate, which means I'm forced to read lots and lots and lots of rule books, and also doing the mystery boxes from Tokyo Game Market, because I don't get to wear the rose-tinted glasses that everyone else gets to wear. So everyone goes, oh, Tokyo Game Market, they create all these amazing games, and like every single one's exciting, and all that. It's generally the misconception that a lot of people have. And I speak to my friends who are Japanese designers, and they're like, not every game from Game Market is good. You do know that. And I was like, I definitely know that. Yeah, there's some absolute nonsense there and just stuff that doesn't work. And the thing is that it's only ever going to get cherry picked by people like me and people who are going to do reviews on it. They're not going to waste their time like reviewing a fuzzy pom-pom on its own that, I don't know, you have to balance on the end of a stick. Like, if that's the whole game, like, no one's going to touch that. So I then kind of realized that it's a bit between going to things like Essen Spiel and then going to, well, not going to, interacting with a lot of the Tokyo Game Market, which I haven't been to, but I will be going next year. I've always done it remotely.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I've realized mostly through speaking to friends who are designers and that kind of thing is the reasoning behind making a game for Game Market is to make a game for your friends to play. Whereas if you go to, and they just bring it along like, I made a cool thing, or I made a cool thing, it mostly works. Like, you'll see a lot of that. And I think mostly works is sometimes good enough. But over like more in the Western world, it's more, I want to be able to market this and contract it to someone else who will publish it and then pay me. So you go to Essen Spiel and you'll see there's an awful lot of people wearing a suit, and they'll turn up to a stand and they'll do a pitch as if it's all very mechanical. It's like, this is a worker placement, it has 56 cards, it's made of wood, like, and I'm like, but why is it fun? Like, that's the bit that's missing. Whereas with Tokyo Game Market, it's like, I made this thing, it's really stupid. Or I made this thing, it's really fun, because there's never like I've made it because of the components, or, you know, there isn't that contract angle with it. And they're usually like, oh, I've made 30 copies. I made them in my living room with glue sticks and whatever. Like, so they're not limited by what can be produced in a factory either. They're limited by what they can get from the craft shop,
mm-hmm.
Which is very, very different. And I kind of, yeah, I've looked around the UK in particular, and there are designers, but a lot of them don't get to the point where they publish it because they think, oh, it's not good enough for a publisher to sign it. So then it just sits on the shelf. So what I've been trying to encourage is, I've been posting up all my stupid ideas into the Travel Games Discord. Whether they work or whether they don't, people can see how it's changing throughout like a week. Or if a project's not done in a week for me, that's it. It goes into the spare parts bin, like, because I've lost interest and I found something else there. I've got a very short attention span. Like, but it'll appear later on somewhere else in pieces. So, but it's quite nice to post the ones that don't work. Like, I've got this stupid idea. I'm going to try and do this. And then you go an hour or so later, you're like, no, it doesn't work. Because then when other people do their first design and it doesn't work, they don't go, well, I can't do it, because they've seen me fail it like 20 times already. So, yeah, I think that's where it came from. And Rotisserie Tricking, I was doing the rules for Boast or Nothing, or Best of Neapolitan, as we've kind of rethemed it. And I've proofread that rules along with Ryan and all the other PGC people who were kind of co-publishing with me. We've all read through them rules so many times. And I kind of had this idea of, I wanted to make a game where there was a minimal number of cards. The cards, basically each card was four cards, depending on how you orientated it. And then I was like, ah, this could be a trick taker. So then I started mucking around with that. And then I was like, ah, but now you get locked into it. If you've got a handful of a particular suit, you've just won. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. And then I was like, ah, but if I take the rotating suits from Boast or Nothing, then that means if you win one trick and you've got a handful of whatever, you've lost that advantage and now someone else has got a chance. And I started playing around with that. And very publicly, I'll say, like, I don't like bidding in trick-taking particularly. I'm coming around to it a bit more, but I find it's a bit of a dark art, really. You have to look at your hand and go, that'll be seven. I'm like, well, I don't know. Say it with confidence and see what happens, I suppose. But with rotisserie tricking, there's only three cards to the trick. So it's very easy to look at three cards and go, well, that's good, that's medium, and that's awful. One or two. Whereas if you've got a handful of 12 cards or something, it's very hard to read that hand. So it's kind of there as a introduction to trick taking more as much as anything else. So, and then it starts off an 18 card game. The actual cards you play with, there's only nine. So it's even smaller than that. And because of that, when I was playtesting with people, there was lots of people like, I can memorize what's on all nine cards. I was like, I don't think you can, but fine. So then I made a chaos mode where basically everyone could be playing on different parts of their cards. And then it's just essentially like a standard deck, but running to 36. And this was like the entire game minus the art. It had my janky art that I just like drew by hand, and it was just like washi tape on the corners and all sorts. It was all done within 2 hours. It was like a proper lightning in a bottle. Like, I have to get this down and have to do it. And it hasn't changed since then. I've moved two ranks around, but that's it. Because there was one hand where, like, if you had these two cards, you have one. So we tweaked to that a bit. But, it was an interesting one, because I then realized that you can design like that. And then the final bit that pulled it all together was just this little catch-up mechanism. So I really like in Quacks of Quedlingburg, the rat tails, because if you've got someone who's streaking ahead and winning, then you've got that chance to like not be out. You don't feel like you're out of the game for the whole thing, basically. Like there is a chance you can come back. So to fix the runaway leader problem that you can get, there's this dial that tells you what flavor of chicken we're playing this round. So if I say we're playing garlic chicken, then everyone's using the garlic quarter of their card and the cards that are on that. So if I'm in last place on the first round, you'll deal out for the second round, look at your hand, and then you can choose whether you spin that wheel clockwise or anti-clockwise one space. But you've already seen your hand, so you can go, well, I can read the garlic cards and the classic flavored chicken cards, and I can see which one I can read better. And I'm like, well, I'm definitely going to get three tricks on that. So then you change it to the one that, like, classic chicken or something, if that's what you think you're going to win with. And then everyone else just has to kind of work through what they've got. And that's meant that it's not too balanced, where everyone's just going to keep moving up together. But it also means there's no one sat on the first space while someone runs through the finish line. So, yeah. And then I got the guy from who does things like Quack Quack Corrupt Ducks, Trick Dumpling. He's a really good friend. Like, I chat with him online. We've never met in person. We're hoping to meet in Tokyo next year. But he never puts games in a proper box. So it's always in like a dumpling steamer or a DVD case or a Coke, or like a can, like a Coke can.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been having a back and forth for a while going, you need to put a game in a crock. And he'll go, no, you need to put a game in a crock. For Beto San, the short story, part of it involves a boy with some yellow crocs who joins Beto San in terrorizing his village. I'm going to make him his own special copy of Beto San, but it's going to come in a big yellow croc. But I think that's where the joy of designing board games comes from. It's like, it's making it for someone. Or just making something fun. And if I make 30 copies and I sell 30 copies, great. If I don't, then, you know, that's fine.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I loved everything about all the stories and thoughts and answers there. There's a lot to unpack. I'm kind of envious, like, how quickly you're able to keep start and pitch. But as you mentioned, there, even if something, like, you know, it's more than a week and it goes to the, like, a future recycling bin, I think that's like a good process too, because it means there was like an idea that had something, had legs, but it just didn't really like mesh for you. But also with the whole rotisserie chicken design and having, like you said, four numbers per card, and figuring out that math, I would have. That's where I would have stopped them. But
It's yeah, I always start a game based like my starting point for all card games is is it an 18 card game? Is it a 36 card game, or is it a 54 card game? And I then worked out that I could fit 36 cards, I think, onto like within that 18 card set if I divide it. And then at that point, it was just a case of flinging stuff in and seeing what happened. But yeah, I should probably say like there is, I think. The way I design things probably works for me, but it wouldn't work for everyone. It's very much it's kind of a realization I've had. So all the way through like education, I've been dyslexic, but I originally used it as a bit of a crutch. I'd be like, I need extra time, I need this, I need that. And I realized that was holding me back. So because what I actually needed was just to do the thing. So I've always been very open with that. When I was lecturing before and things like that, I tell my students, "Oh, I'm dyslexic as well. This is how I, what my coping mechanisms are." And then a couple of years back, I was tested for ADHD, but not. I'm not very outwardly presenting with it. I just get very hyper focused or very uninterested. Basically, it has to be super interesting or super boring, and I'll do it. Anything in the middle, not interested. Which is why I've kind of weaponized that and gone. If I'm designing something, it needs to be done now. And I give myself this deadline of like, get it done today or like maximum a week, because as soon as it drops into that gray area, it's gone. So it's just kind of how I've learned the coping mechanism to go with it, I think.
Well, first off, yeah, thank you for sharing that. And secondly, I think that's just in general, fantastic advice is just thinking about, well, yeah, that there's definitely not like a, you said, this type of design philosophy or the way they go about it, it's not going to work for everybody. But I think just combining what you just said and kind of designing for somebody, it's yeah, I mean, you really kind of have to like find what works for you and not just like, oh, this is what's going to work for me to like make a good game, but this is what's going to work for me in order to design in a way that's going to, like be fulfilling and engaging and just kind of like find the avenues that work best for me, and that could be something that is very independent for a few people. Or if you really want to create something that's going to be bigger and hit a wide audience, then I'm sure there's different ways to like think about that and go about that too. And yeah, I
Yeah.
don't know. I just think that's really good advice. So thank you.
I think the constraints is a big thing for me as well. Like I like that the Tokyo, I've recently found out that the Tokyo Game Market has a little internal competition where they go, these are the components for this competition and these are the themes you need to be in to be eligible to enter the competition. So there's one coming up for next game market, which I've been working on, and I've ended up with two designs because one of them broke and then I fixed it, that kind of thing. But it was 30 cards and I think it was about 36 little tokens that come on card-shaped punch boards. And because it was 30 cards and not 36, it's been really, really hard to design something. But having that limitation of like, you can't have anything else. You're not allowed a dice. You're not allowed a some meeples or anything else like that. It was interesting. It's been an interesting kind of thing to work around. So I always start with, yeah, some constraints of you're only having this many cards for a start or something like that. Because I have no idea how people design those like bigger, more sprawling games. As soon as there's a board on the table and there's text on cards that says, this if you've got this card, do this, I have no idea how to design that. That's big brain stuff.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny because yeah, I've definitely like thought about things that I think at least in terms of like scope wind up being sprawling, but then in my head, even within like the design spaces, I'm like, okay, how can I shrink that down though? Like, and yeah, I won't like go into too much because it doesn't exist, but I'm like, oh, like, you know, there's this, but I'm like, oh, this could probably be like a booklet, maybe something like a Jaws of the Line booklet where like you go from, you know, page 2 to 27 to 15 or whatever it is, depending on like design space, instead of, oh, here's, you know,
A million
80
tiles.
tiles and you're just gonna like
Yeah.
randomly generate. It's like, no, let's shrink it down. So even if I want to get like a little zany, my brain does kind of go to some of those constraints as well. Very cool. Okay, so I said I was gonna cheat. I'm only cheating because I don't think you would ever pick this based on the way I can hold the box. Here, I'll hold the box
Okay.
again, but you can see that you'll never see it. So I think probably in this right corner, this is kind of like in that like trinkety toy thing. So this is the one thing, well, one of two things I didn't actually wrap, and it was something, and it's tied to something that you mentioned, but it is a spoon.
Okay.
I don't have those cool ice cream scoops. I remember growing up, well, first off, I grew up, you had the one where you'd scoop and then you kind of like
And you press the little
click,
button.
you'd be like click it or press the button and it like move the
Oh, the window wiper.
yeah, the window. Yep. So I didn't have, but well, we don't have any one of those in our house. And furthermore, I remember having like just like a regular scoop. You kind of, you know, get it hot and then it stays warm and it helps you scoop, but we're not, we have spoons. And also I don't really scoop, I just eat. So I think this is more fitting. But you mentioned Best of Neapolitan, and I guess I had a question, but I'm going to change it. You know, kind of going along with going from, travel games to you designing, but if you kind of want to explain travel games into you like publishing, and I know that it has been different venues, and I think, you know, furthermore, there's the idea of like retheming, re-implementing, redoing a game in a sense, as opposed to, you know, localizing or something like that. So if you kind of want to describe just kind of like the process that you've taken, what you've done, and where you're at and where you're going, I guess.
That's actually a really good question. So the way in which I ended up acquiring Most or Nothing as it was at the time was originally I wanted to sign a game for Travel Games, and I went about it all the wrong way. So the game in question was Roll and Write Die Fugu, which turned into Nirvana. I basically did draw up all my art ideas for it and what tweaks would be made and all that kind of thing. So instead of roll and writing your cards and writing them down on cards, you'd have these dry erase cards where you could transfer it from your sheet onto some actual cards and play them to the table, things like that. And they were like digital clock kind of numbers, so you could color in over the top of the ones you didn't need. And I spent a good 2 weeks on it, and then I went to the designer and was like, "Can I do this?" And he went, "It's already signed." I was like, And I was chatting with Lee from the Portland Game Collective, and I was saying like, "Oh, I've done this, and it all didn't work because of because I'm a Muppet basically, and I did it backwards." And he was like, "Oh, just aim really big," and I was like, "Okay." So then I took a like look over my shelves, and I was like, "There's one trick taker which fixed trick taking for me because I didn't originally like it at all. Like, I really bounced off the crew. I do not like Skull King. I still don't like it. And they were my two like first ones that I'd bring to the club, and like no one will play those games because we had that kind of bad experience with them to start with. So I was like, oh, maybe I just don't like trick taking." And then someone got me in the Portland Game Collective. Secret Santa got me a copy of Boast or Nothing. And I took it along and I was like, oh, I get it now. And I think it's a lot of it's to do with that rotating suit, in that it stops you getting locked into having one person who just wins the last five tricks, which I find really boring. So I was like, well, that's the game that fixed it for my group and fixed it for me. And I really like it. I wouldn't do anything to it. So I contacted the designer for that and said, "Oh, would you be interested in me signing this?" Like, and he said, "Yes, but you can't have the art because that was like a one and done by a very famous Korean artist, and he just wanted to do it for that publication. So you can have, like, you can buy the rights for the game, but no art. I was like, okay. And then I was like, yeah, I'll do that. But I have a bit of a thing where I don't like it when a Western publisher purchases the rights to a game and then takes away the original art. Like, if I could have kept it, I would have kept it. And then replaces it with, like, generic Western clip art art. Yeah, I think there's various ones that have done it recently that just, I don't know. Like, replacing Sashi and Sashi art with a clip art bear for Higgy just didn't really do it for me. Yeah, there's quite a few. There's a re-implementation of King's Trick Takers that was done in France, and that's, like, taken away the anthropomorphic animals and just replaced it with a whale or a bear or a fish. And it, yeah, you look at it on the table, it just doesn't have that presence. So I was very keen on, like, I want to keep it looking kind of Korean or Japanese or whatever. And I went through loads of artists that were both Korean and Japanese because I wanted that kind of feel to it. And I, we were just, me and Sam were unpacking, my wife Sam, were unpacking boxes for the shop that just a load of games had come through. And I'd had 12 Seekers from Akazu brand through. And Sam looked at this monster on the front of this box and was like, that. And I was like, yes, that. And I didn't think, because the Akazu brand's fairly big on the Japanese publishing side, I thought, they're not going to want to do that. And so I messaged anyway, and worst they can say is no. And they're like, yeah, absolutely. And since then, I've worked with Ryoko on Best of Neapolitan, the Travel Games Compendium, and she's also doing the artwork for Dot and Dash, which me and Sam designed. So yeah, we met up with them in Japan. Yeah, lovely. Fantastic to work with. So she did that, and she sent through a first load of sketches. We had a very I had to get both kind of a mutual friend, Eric, to translate a letter to Ryoko from the first sketches, which was hilarious, because there's the hairy chocolate monster, who originally didn't look like that. there's, like, the pink kind of lizardy monster, and then there's the vanilla dragon. And this chocolate hairy monster originally looked very much like a big hairy penis. And I was like, how do I write this? Put it through machine translation and know that it hasn't just, like, gone hugely offensive and, like, written something like, all your pictures look like penises. I was like, I don't trust this at all. So I was like, Eric, can you write me a very polite thing just asking them to make it a bit less penis? So yeah, it's got some extra arms and it's got a bit of, yeah, messed up hair at the top now to try and disguise that a little bit. So, okay. But yeah, that was quite funny. And then, like, again, in keeping, because we couldn't have the original art, we kept it so that as you increment through the numbers, the boasting or the showing off about ice cream gets incrementally stupider and stupider. There's also little things like, so on, I can't remember if it's odds or evens, doesn't really matter, but so odd cards, for example, are just the one soup monster on his own. And then the even ones would then be them as a three competing with each other, and then it'd keep switching in between there. And then there's a few little Easter eggs hidden in there, which I won't give them all away because I think part of the fun is finding them. But we did contact the original artist, which took a lot of going through lots and lots of people to get to them. And we've managed to have the original Cloud guy from the original game make a cameo in one of the cards. So they're at a cocktail party with the original Cloud guy, which probably won't make a lot of sense to anyone who hasn't seen the original art. But they'll be like, what's this going on here? But it was a nice nod. And then our kind of key thing that we'd always discuss between me and Portland Game Collector is we want it to be, like, the original one's quality was great, so we need to be at least that good, preferably better. So, like, where it's got gold plating, like, on the tokens, we've done the same thing. So, yeah, we kept it. So you can still play the original. And then I've got a variant in there, which adds a few cards, messes with the pass cards, because originally quite a few people find them quite overpowered. So I did a bit of a tweak with that, which I'll let people find out a bit more about that when that turns up. But that's going in the Kickstarter as well. And then there's another one which adds a bit more to the kind of bidding, and makes it a bit more chaotic. But you can take them out, put them in, play the original mode. It's kind of there as if people want it rather than otherwise. But yeah, it was a really fun process. It's taken a lot longer than planned. Partly was me learning how to do arranged cards and discussing artwork in other languages is more of a challenge than you think. And then we had the Trump tariff nonsense, which just knocked the whole thing onwards. So, but I think we're getting there with getting that solved and printed and sent over. So hopefully the Kickstarter can start soon.
Yeah, well, I hope so too, because well, a couple fun things. Shout out to Eric. Thanks for doing some of the translating. Making this game still live and not offending artists by making them think that all of their artwork is phallic. But yeah, so I guess the funny link is Eric and I just went to Gen Con together, and I just played Boast or Nothing for the first time. So at the convention, so that was really cool, and it's making me even more excited for Best of Neapolitan. And oh yeah,
Have
I
you got a
kind of
favorite card?
I oh well,
Because there's some pretty interesting cards in that
there are. I would definitely have to look at them again, because that was like, well, I mean, basically we played before, a couple few days before going. It's like 6 days, 40 total plays, and I think maybe more games played than like hours slept. So I did not sleep, and I'll look again. But we were looking at the art a bit, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, because you have way more experience with this, and I'm curious too if it's something that you kept. The highest value you could play with, is that the 11?
I think, yes. I'm gonna
Well,
go with
we'll just
I
say
think
it, but
numbers.
yeah, numbers. Oh, we'll just say whatever. For the highest value card, that was like the only piece of art that was repeated for the three suits.
Yeah,
Okay.
think that's the one where he's some kind of god or deity or
Yep.
something. It's like, yeah, yeah,
Yeah. There's like God and Buddha underneath them.
yeah. And there's I think my favorite one's the fish with legs. It's just bizarre. Like they're all wearing fishing attire, and there's just this fish with legs, and you're like, why?
Okay, I've got to see how many pieces of art the that's kind of a bummer. The BON page doesn't really have too many of the cards like visible or featured. There's nine total images on the thing, and I think one of them is the Best of Neapolitan cover as well. But
If
yeah.
anyone wants like the to see what all the cards, well, most of the cards in Best of Neapolitan are, it's got the full artwork now on Trickster's table, so you can play it against a computer basically, and all the artwork's got there. Admittedly, a bit small, but yeah, it gives you a good idea.
Awesome. Okay, I'll put that in the notes as well. Okay, a couple. Well, your answer, like your response to, why you picked the design of Boast or Nothing initially, answered one of my questions, and that was kind of like the fact that, I think from, like a reason to want to like republish something would be, scarcity compared to like the desire. Like, this game is not available, people want to play it. But then obviously there would have to be like another reason for you to want to do it, and you explained that it was the game that fixed a trick taking for you, and that's really neat that you were able to be able to do this then, because it wasn't just like, oh, this is a good game that people want, let's see how we can get to them, which is great. Like, I mean, that's like a very like awesome thing to like want to help out people to get their hands on something, help the designer get their design out there more. But being able to have that personal link and love to the game, and just ask, and have it work.
think it also helped that everyone was busy looking at Japan, and it's a Korean game. So, like, there was loads of big games being snapped up at that time, and no one had thought to ask about that one for some reason. So I was just very lucky. And then, yeah, when I did get the contract sorted, I went, oh no, like, I have to fulfill this into America, and I don't know what I'm doing particularly. So I was like, Lee, just put in Game Collective one of hell. So, yeah, that's how that kind of collaboration happened. And then I've been, yeah, they've taught me bits about Kickstarter, and whenever I get stuck with how do I arrange the cards, it's been nice to have people to go, what do I do? Or have I done this right? So yeah, that's worked quite nicely. I think I do get drowned out because I'm the smaller of the two collaborators. But that's kind of all part of it really. So yeah.
It's that is interesting and tricky, but at I think at end of the day, like, it's nice to have a community to help. It's also nice that when the game is out there, like, a community that's going to recognize, oh, Tribal Games that coded UK on there as well. And I know that plenty of people like myself who appreciate all of your contributions and getting a lot of awesome games into my
Yeah.
hands too. Okay, cool. Wow, this is intimidating. There are, I think kind of like pre oh, I do have a follow-up question. So here, this is it. This is the plan. There are five more items in this box. So if I'm doing math, which I've already admitted that I'm not good at math, like, getting through them is going to take longer than it has for us to talk in the first place. So we'll do this. I'll ask the follow-up question to the spoon, the spoon. And then, yeah, like I said, you did like I've like usually I have like two or three questions. You basically answered all of them, but I do have one follow-up. We will pick one more item. So you got to pick a good one.
Okay.
Because,
I was gonna say we can do a speed round if you want.
no, this is good. This is gonna be very on par slash on brand with me talking into the void and having my camera cut out like midway through when I was doing my unboxing. So this is like, honestly, this is perfect. The parallels will be on point. And then hopefully, oh gosh, I think I snorted. That's like my first podcast snort, so you're welcome. So hopefully, like, when I get Best Neapolitan and all these other things, we can come back. We can take a look at the rest of the box, in the future. I think I love.
The box has been held up in customs.
Yes.
Standard stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's on par with scary board game happenings. Okay. Oof. So we'll grab one more. You got one more in here. And then I'll get to like the wrap up questions, which actually kind of ties to this one too, but maybe not necessarily even things that you can announce yet, because if there's not, that's completely fine. But I guess, based on the process of Best Neapolitan and your work with Tribal Games, like I said, just kind of branching out, doing all these different things, design, game market boxes, publishing, all that different stuff. And I think that's like super awesome. Do you feel as if this process is one that you're like wanting to continue? And again, you might be like working on different titles. Like, is this something that you're going forward with now? Like, just adding more and more work to yourself for yourself.
But yeah, so I think I'll keep doing bits of everything because I think that's what keeps it interesting, if I'm honest. Like if it was just me, I've said this a few times to various people, but if it was just a standard board game shop where I go into a big spreadsheet by Asmodee or Coiled Spring or whoever, I select some items, they appear at my door, I list them, put them in boxes, send them out. If there was no letters, no stickers, no conversations, no Discord, and you didn't have that interaction, I don't think I could do this job. The thing that makes it is that I'm buying games from people who are making them in their living rooms and chatting with them about things I'm making, things that they're making, like just normal conversations, really. I don't like buying off the spreadsheets. I find it really tedious. And there's always like loads of like loopholes, not loopholes, like things you have to jump over. So it's like you have to spend over this amount, or like you have to buy so many things every so many months, or we'll kick you off the register. Whereas if you're just dealing with just a normal person in their house making things, they don't care. They're like, oh, I'll make 10 copies, or I'll make three. Like, it doesn't really matter. So yeah. And then if I'm struggling with doing one task, then I'll just bounce over and do something a bit creative instead. If I'm not getting anywhere in creative land, then I'll just do some listing or some accounts, or yeah. I guess the nickname Mr. Ben that kind of stuck actually fits in more ways than one, because it was like fall off my chair. it was like a 70s, 80s cartoon, and it was a guy that used to go into a fancy dress shop and he'd put on a different hat, and then he'd morph into being a knight or a chef or whatever. So it does kind of work in that, like, today I've got my, I don't know, design hat on, and tomorrow I've got my accounts hat on, and now I've got my marketing hat on. So yeah, it's just one person with many hats. But yeah, it's one of those things that rather than stalling on a task, I find it easier just to bounce onto a different one for a little bit. I'm more interested in getting smaller indie designs printed at small quantities,
mm-hmm.
and giving people a bit of confidence to design and make a thing than I am doing bigger kind of localizations, partly down to space. I mean, I'm pretty terrified of thousands of copies of a game turning up at my house. That's a little bit terrifying. But also, like, you're then competing against bigger companies that can do it bigger. They'll probably pay less to the person who designed it, because I try and treat it fairly. Like, if an artist comes to me and underprices themselves because they've been underpriced elsewhere, I'll chuck them a bit extra, because they, you know, they should be paid for it. I can't do what they do.
Yeah.
And I'm very much kind of a believer in, if you pay someone to do a thing, you don't interfere with it too much, because they're the specialist, you're not. So it's quite funny, like, some artists will be like, I need more direction, and I'm like, just do what you like and it's all good. Like, as long as it's not offensive, like, you'll get a tick. Like, I might ask for little tweaks, but, you know, I'm not going to say, like, here's something that I drew or mocked up, make it good, because, you know, that's not my skill set. So, yeah, it's that kind of thing, I think, really. So probably less localizations unless something really jumps out at me. I mean, Trick-Taking Werewolf, I did, because no one was looking at it. It's really good, but it had language dependency because all the cards had text on. So, and it's, I mean, it's a micro game. You play multiple rounds of it until you're bored. But it feels like a Tokyo Game Market game because it's really unusual in how it plays. And I thought it just deserved a bit of a spotlight on it, because everyone's looking at the ones that are language independent. Sometimes we miss out on those ones that aren't. So that was a case of, I think we had a print run of 250. I've probably got like 12 left.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I reprint again, I don't know. I guess I'll just kind of see what the wait list looks like, and once it gets up to another number, or if I do a Kickstarter, I might tag it on. But it was more for that kind of thing than anything else. So if something grabs me, then yeah. And yeah, with that one, I also kind of improved the quality of life stuff. So originally it was printed on business cards and it came in a Jiffy bag. So I thought it would just be a case of take the artwork that was already made, change the text, send it to the printers. Then I realized business cards are not the same size as normal cards. And then I did things like change the color of the accents on the clothes so that they match the suits. Put a very faint colored background on the cards just so that when you fan them out, you can see what they are. Just little things like that, because a lot of Tokyo Game Market games aren't fully polished. So, but I haven't changed the artwork. Oh, and I gave it a box, which, yeah, is part of it. But yeah, I think there'll be more things like that again, that a small print runs maybe up to 200. But yeah, because I know I can clear them.
Nice. Well, I mean, makes a lot of sense, like all sides of it, and just kind of like your explanation as to your goals and like again, kind of the different work and things that you're doing, but also you know the care that's going into each one of them as well. Like it's not going to be like, hey, I want to just sign five games to like sell them. It's like, okay, no, I really like this game. I want to do it in this way to help it be or help it reach different languages or like whatever it might be. I think again,
Well,
very.
that was the other thing we did with Trick Werewolves, because it doesn't use that many cards. And I worked out there was enough language-dependent cards in it to make it in three languages. So I had it translated into French. So some of the cards, you can basically take out the English ones, put the French cards in, take the French ones out and put the Brazilian ones in. So the first print one was going to be English, French, Brazilian. And then if I print it again, it'll be English, German, probably Italian. But it just, yeah, it opens up a little bit wider, just, and it costs no more to do apart from the time it takes to translate it, obviously. But those cards would have otherwise been blank cards that would have been paid for and then thrown in the bin. So you might as well do something with it. So, and it's been really, really cool to see it like turn up in South America. And I get these random post, like Instagram posts that are all in like Brazilian text, and I cannot read them. And I'm like, someone just got my game. Like, how does that work? So that's pretty cool. And yeah, I'll be doing the same for Rotisserie Trick, and we'll have different languages and stuff, probably online, not in the box, but.
Oh, yeah, I think that's great. And yeah, well, I am not going to be doing anything in the, publishing, localization, any space, but I think if I were, I would hope to kind of like approach it in a very similar manner, but I won't. That's not the
Sure,
way
you
my Yeah, you have shelves behind you. I have a floor
but you
of
can't see the floor that's in
okay.
front of the shelves.
All right, fair enough. But
And if it's Tokyo Game Market, I make like an igloo and I just live inside my
I
little Game Market igloo.
Oh, that is hilarious. Yeah, I mean that's the thing. You made that though. For me, I would just be like on like a pile of boxes and they'd be like poking me at whatever, like, oh, this one's bigger than the other one. Ooh, okay, last item before just kind of like our wrap up thoughts. Oh my gosh, let's see.
Is the white piece of paper an item?
Oh, okay, so this is hilarious. This is not a, this doesn't have a question, but I'll show you and no one else gets to see it. So this is a picture. It was in my room when I was looking for something else in this box, but this is me in high school with my dog sleeping like around my head. So it's just like it was like the picture touch. So if you saw this, which you did, you get a picture just like the some of the designer included pictures in the TGM boxes. So okay. All right.
Fair
So
enough.
all right. No
Well,
question, no
pick an
question.
actual item.
Pick an actual item.
The pink one.
Ooh, do you know what? Okay, I did not do any resorting. Like this is the way those boxes, shaken out through the course of our
I
thing.
thought it looked like it was like a little pig with legs, with just how it was kind of sat in the box.
But I was kind of hoping you'd click this one or pick this one. Click, I guess, is works because here we'll unwrap it, and I have well, this Google documents all over the place. But the funny thing is, well, this is an NES controller, because you mentioned that you liked indie games and also old wired video games. So I was like in this mess, technically underneath the table to my right. I had the hardest piece of prep I've ever had for any interview, and I was going to look for. I have one of those Sega classics, so it's like the I don't know, came out 5 years ago. It's like an emulator, but it was the official one that Sega put out. So there's 30 something games on it or whatever, and it's really cool. But when I was doing some reorganizing, and I haven't actually done the reorganizing, I like packed up a lot of my older video game consoles. So I didn't even know that I had like this NES controller. So I like bust bro start breaking open boxes. Then I have one that has a bunch of controllers. So it's like, oh, this is probably better than a new piece of technology pretending to be an old piece of technology. It's a legitimate NES controller. So I was moving big boxes and doing a puzzle game, and I found this, which is great. So, like I said, you mentioned that you your video game tastes do fall into like older, like wired consoles or indie games, and then I guess like, why would you say that you're particularly drawn to these types of games?
I think it's probably a familiarity thing. So I didn't go past the PlayStation 1 basically when I had consoles. So then kind of when I got a job, finished university, got a job, whatever, we needed something to play Netflix, so I got a PlayStation 3, I think. And I put a game in and went, oh dear, everything's too fast. Like, because we now have decent amounts of RAM and things. So, like, reaction times just didn't have them. I was like, I can't do this. I can't even get through, like, the tutorial. So it just became a DVD player and a Netflix thing because, yeah, with that. And then more recently, I kind of got into emulating older stuff. So, generally, a lot of handheld stuff. So like Game Boy Advance, Game Boy Color, that kind of era, really, bits of PlayStation. And then down that rabbit hole, I found Game Boy Studio, which is a kind of very plug and like drag and drop kind of thing, which makes you enables you to make Game Boy cartridges for Game Boy Color and Game Boy Normal. And there's like a little kind of community around that, which is very feels very much like the Tokyo Game Market community, and it's just people making things because they want to make them for their friends more than anything else. And it's so there's a nice batch of kind of new Game Boy and Game Boy Color games. But seeing as time has passed since the Game Boy Color was there, like game design has moved on massively. So, but you've still got those restrictions. And again, I think it comes back to those restrictions of like me liking to work within 36 cards, for example. They're now working with, can I fit it onto a like dusty old cartridge, which is very limiting. And because they can take kind of modern design things and then work out how do I squish that down. One of the big games that kind of stood out to me, in fact, he's done a whole series now, it's by a designer called Ben Jelter. And he designed a game called The Machine, which is basically like a very, I think it's called a pancake RPG. So it's wide rather than deep, if that makes sense. But you wake up on the first level in school in an exam, and it just goes through these questions. And you can either try and cheat when the teacher's not looking, which isn't necessarily going to get you the right answer, but it might do. You can answer the question that you know, but you'll only learn the answers by playing the game and looping back through over and over again. And if you fail the test, then you have the choice to be a policeman or a factory worker. And they have two different mini games that go with that, and the story will progress depending on who you speak to, what happens, that kind of thing. And it's very dark humor. Like it's called The Machine for a reason. And at the end of most endings, it's going to go, and the machine grinds on, and like it's just this mobile city on wheels, basically, that just rolling around smashing things. But you can, as you do the test more and more, you can become like a hippie who wants to kind of overthrow the, you can like support different parties. Like the decision tree that must be behind this thing, it must be huge. And it just sucked me in. Like it's really good. You can end up like being a drugs mule at some point. You end up like being tested on and turned into an animal. Like it's just bizarre, and it's really good. But he also does a lot of horror ones as well, which are kind of like short stories, choose your own adventure. But he is an artist originally, not a game designer. So the pixel art in it is amazing. And like in the machine, you can go into the art gallery and he's just done like proper paintings. You can click on it, just opens it up on the full screen. But yeah, really, really good. There's another one called Possum Country where everyone is just possums in skin suits. yeah.
Oh,
So
wow.
it's that kind of, yeah, design. And there's usually a lot of storytelling in the more indie games at the moment. So yeah, I think that's what dragged me in to it more. And then there's like Pico 8 Games, which is an imaginary console, which I really like. Again, it's made accessible so that you're very constrained. It doesn't actually have a physical console. You just kind of download the thing that runs it, and it's a bit like MS-DOS, but more accessible. And people design games on it, and you can only have so many colors, so much space, so on and so forth. But the creativity that goes into it, I think, is the draw there.
That, yeah, like I, not to like repeat a word, it was an early morning, but I think like the parallels, I said parallels already and I don't like repeating words too many times, but I think the parallel between like the taste in the kind of like the board game spaces that you're interested in and kind of like the avenues in which to like obtain and enjoy and share and have that community make a lot of sense with like the thoughts here. And furthermore, you're going to send me down some like dangerous rabbit holes too, because like I mean, interest, I'm not like in terms of, you know, modern big games and kind of the games that you're talking about, I'm probably like here, like close, like I, a lot of the indie games that I play are things that are playable on Steam and are pretty like accessible, and most people would know about most of the things that I am playing, I guess. Like,
yeah,
and most people who like at least are in video games, not necessarily. It is funny because like my subreddits are a lot of like, you know, roguelite or Metroidvanias and things like that. So I like tell people, I'm like, oh yeah, like these are the games I play. Like, you know, they're pretty popular. It's like, I haven't heard of that. I'm like, okay. Like, okay, within like this realm, they're popular games. So I'm still in a niche, but yeah, this is dangerous. And I think like handhelds are awesome.
Yeah, they've definitely moved on in the last few years. Like the oldest one I've got is so janky and rubbish. And then like the ones that are coming out now are pretty, like once you've tinkered around a little bit, they're pretty much flawless. And like the weirdest thing is that this is looping back to, I think, the very first question, but I've actually read more books in the last year because I've got a handheld thing, because they work as e-readers. So you can put EPUBs on, and because the one that I use, I mean, again, no one's going to benefit from this because it's it's on here, but like this is the Miu Mini. So it's
okay,
really, really small, but you just click, yeah, it lives in my pocket. And then if I get bored, you open up, and usually I'll boot up a book over a game. So actually, like, I get through tons more books just by having it in my pocket. And I couldn't fit a Kindle in my pocket.
Yeah.
And if I try and do it with my phone, which everyone goes, oh, why don't you just read your book on your phone? Like, that handheld doesn't give me notifications. It doesn't buzz. It doesn't, like, as soon as that happens when I'm trying to read a book, you're not reading the book anymore. You're now going, scrolling through something nonsense, yeah. Or responding to someone's email. So, yeah, it's kind of like the Swiss Army knife of games and books.
Well, and that's kind of perfect too, because, well, yeah, if I'm reading, I haven't really done much e-reading, but if I do read, and you mentioned like phone buzzing, like I can't have my phone by me. If my phone is on me, like I like shove it somewhere where if like it were to buzz, I can't even hear it. So yeah, if I was reading on my phone, but it's also like, and it's not like I even care too much about what people think, because I mean, first off, if I looked like I was playing like a little game console or something, like the optics would be that I'm playing a game, maybe not reading.
Yeah,
I just feel like, I don't know, it still like looks like you're engaged in something. Like if you're on your phone, it's just, it look passive. Or if you're playing games, like, oh, playing a game. Yeah. Don't bug me. Oh, I like that. But okay. Oh, I kind of answered all my questions and then some, and then also presented me with like dangerous counsels that I will probably look at immediately after talking and things like that. But
You
that's
don't need more than one retro handheld. We just won't look over this side.
okay. You do not need
No. One
oh.
decent one is definitely better than having a stack of them and going, why have I got like eight of these things?
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. All right, not to, I don't have the retro handhelds. Like I said, everything I do is mostly Steam still, but there's just, I don't know. Once I got like a Steam Deck, which is a very, very modern, powerful piece of technology, like I don't play console games anymore. I don't know. I just which I mean, some of them are console games, but I don't know. There's something different. I like handhelds. Okay, enough of me going off the deep end there. But kind of to the two wrap up thoughts, my forever penultimate question. We've talked about this has been Mystery Box. So we've talked about books, we talked about video games, we talked about board games, movies, shows. Is there anything else, because you've probably brought up at least a dozen different things, that has kind of been like on your mind that you've really been enjoying in any space, any text that you haven't mentioned so far? I was gonna say that's tough because like you basically I've been asking you
I've
everything
bounced
that you
around
have.
everywhere.
Yeah, I know.
So it just kind of linked back to my like doing lots of reading around Japanese folklore and all that kind of stuff. But the one thing I have been listening to an awful lot of is there's a podcast called Uncanny Japan, which is written by an author who's got Bram Stoker Award for horror kind of stories, which has got a really good kind of audiobook kind of voice to go with it. But it's where she kind of puts her research that she does to write the stories, because it's always based on an original folklore thing with a twist. And there's hundreds of episodes. I think I'm like 150 episodes in, and I've only been listening for about 3 weeks. So yeah, but it's one of those things where I'm listening to it, I'm enjoying the stories, and then something will click. This is part of why I've got so many games designed in the last month, because I'll be like, ah, I could use that, and that would be this. And then, yeah, so I've ended up with a game about some yokais cleaning like people's houses when they're asleep. And then there's another one, which is about basically ranking. It's rankings of sushi or things like coffee. So instead of saying like the best rank, the medium rank, and the peasant rank, it's pine, bamboo, and then umai, which is plum. So if you have the pine one, that's the highest grade, and then so on and so forth. And I thought, well, that actually lends itself quite nicely to some game design there. So that's what's kind of rattling around in my brain now. And yeah, I want to kind of inside. After you better, Sam, and the other games that have come from basically listening to this podcast, I'm going to direct people that way so that they can fall into the trap of listening to hundreds of episodes too. But yeah, I think that definitely needs a shout out because I've been really enjoying those.
Yeah, that's awesome. And like you said, it ties into like a lot of things that we have been talking about, that Japanese folklore and just being able to listen to so many episodes and keep pulling ideas out. You're gonna have to like just keep cranking out these games to keep up with all the different like stories that you've been hearing about.
Do think it's interesting that I tend to like lean to the podcast generally leads to the more creepy kind of monsters, probably because she's a horror writer. But whenever I make go, ah, I can make a game of that, it's always like the silly ones. Like there's one that just like comes into your bedroom while you're asleep and puts your pillow by your feet and then buggers off. Like that kind of thing just, I don't know, just triggers my kind of creativity, I suppose. I'm like, that's a little bit stupid. I can do something with that.
It strikes like a really solid balance between that is creepy and that's scary, but it's not off the deep end,
Yeah.
and And just kind of thinking about it and the absurdity and like the, I don't know, it's funny. Like it's dark humor.
Yeah, and if you're going to put art on something, you don't want to like scare everyone off. You kind of want them to have a bit of a laugh. Well, that's how I come at it anyway. So, yeah.
That is perfect. Well, that definitely leads us well to our final question then too. We talked about Best Neapolitan. We talked about rotisserie chicken. We've mentioned that your design page has a handful of games, but it's missing a handful that have like popped up in the last few weeks as well, then too. But I guess, oh, and then your store, which I will make sure that is linked so people can check out all of these really like unique games from all around the world
Everywhere.
that
Yeah,
from everywhere.
it's quite Japan focused and Korea focused, but actually it's becoming more and more kind of South America, places like that, quite a few from Europe now. Weirdly, the hardest place for me to import from is Europe. Thank you, Brexit. Seems it's the closest place, but never mind. So,
That is funny. But yeah, so and we talked about the mystery boxes and I guess we talked about a lot of the things that you currently are working on, but I guess that I mean even that shout towards you said South America as well. Are there things that you a particular project, general things that we have or haven't talked about that you want to kind of like shout out more for people to be on the lookout for from you?
I think the only one I would probably want to mention is Dot and Dash, which is up. There's no artwork up for it yet because that's being done at the moment by Ryoko, who did the Best of Neapolitan art. This is the first game I designed with my wife, and it's also it kind of a lot of my games I design tend to have that rotating trump suit, and it doesn't have that. It's also not a trick taker, which is also a bit of a kind of sidestep for me. And the other thing is, it's not a fixed player count, which weirdly, a lot of the games that I design or publish tend to be locked in at a specific player count. Like we could have made Trick Werewolf 3 to 5 player instead of 4 player, but the 3 player experience would have been awful. The 5 player just isn't as good as the 4 player, so we'll just lock it down. And it's the same with rotisserie chicken. You can't make that variable player count without creating a whole new deck for each player count, just due to the, how it's made. So I've been having a laugh with a few friends that I just make fixed con like fixed player count games, always trick takers, always with a rotating trump. And then this idea kind of came to me, and it morphed a lot because I sat down with my wife and we'd just play it multi-handed, kept tweaking it, and it's very much like a 50-50 in who's put what into it. And it's based on first of all, we're both dyslexic, and it's got starts with word game. So that's always a good start. But it's based on Morse code. So you pick a word for per round, and the person who's losing will pick the next word for the round again to give you. It's got that little catch-up mechanism I quite like putting into things so that you can look at what cards you've got and kind of go from there. Then your hand is made up of two suits, 1 to 7, repeating 4 times, I think, maybe 5 times. And they're dots or dashes, and they go 1 to 7. And then, so your first letter of your word, you look at what the Morse code is, and you'd have to play that sequence. And then it's kind of like a climbing game, but everyone does a simultaneous reveal. So a bit like poker, a bit like climbing. And then whoever's got the highest strength meld will win that kind of trick. And then you move on to the next letter and the next letter. But it's quite interesting because you can also just pass and just play a number of cards that don't match. So if you can see the letters coming down the line and you're like, oh, I've got a really good hand for a letter Q, then you can hold that back and just fail at this one and know that the next time you're going to absolutely smash it out of the park. So you can kind of grow how strong your hand is as well, which is quite nice. And yeah, I think it's one of my favorite designs that I've done. That and rotisserie tricking are very much at the same kind of level of, I'm really proud of those two. So the reason why rotisserie tricking isn't on Kickstarter yet is because the artwork's been done for Dot and Dash, and I'm thinking of just combining the two into the same Kickstarter, rather than running back to back and just drag it out, because everyone I've put it in front of has really enjoyed it. So it's always nice when you put it in front of playtesters and they go, "Have you got anything to say about it?" And they go, "No." Like, yes. It's when they go, "Have you thought of it?" And like, "Oh no, it's broken." So
That sounds great. And then I guess just as you know it and if you were to guess right now as to like when you think that Kickstarter for both Dot and Dash and Rotisserie Trickin' would be based on art finalization and then and all that. What are you thinking? Just so people can be like, well, I want
I'm
to look at that.
thinking mid-autumn, I think,
Okay.
realistically. It could be a little bit sooner than that, but I think it probably needs a bit of time to let people know that it's coming rather than just lobbing it straight up there.
It's like, oh, we're ready now. Here you are.
So,
That's very smart.
especially as people know a bit more about rotisserie tricking, it's had a couple of videos. I've sent out promo copies of around a bit. So, whereas Dot and Dash, you can't really proxy it, and I can't print it until I've got the artwork. So, it's a bit further behind in those stages.
That is fantastic. There are so many things that people can be looking out for from you between, the games you're designing, the ones you're publishing, the ones you're selling. And yeah, I'm after playing Boast or Nothing, I was very, very excited to look more into Best of Neapolitan. And coincidentally, the timing worked out where I could just hear more from you. So that was perfect too. Because I saw that it was announced. And I've definitely heard of my Boast before, but I was kind of like, I don't really know that much about it. And I love trick-taking games. I think I probably played more in the past week than I've played in the past like 2 years. So that made me really, well, the fact that I got to play them made me really happy. The fact that I typically don't really get to play a ton makes me less happy. But no, it re like invigorated this passion. And like you said, going back to the beginning, just the ability to kind of like teach. We'd kind of talk through a rules explanation and it'd be like, okay, must follow, blah blah blah. You just like say like a few things to kind of like summarize everything that you said. It's like, oh, all right, we'll see how it goes.
The only problem with that is if you've got someone who's new to it, it's not
Yes.
very accessible at all. It's quite like, "You're not welcome here because you don't understand our language." Like, yeah, I do have to be very careful about going into those kind of teachers. But
That is the truth. But well, nonetheless, we have been talking for quite some time, and I know you've been like that. You said you've been working on a whole bunch of things, and that's very, very obvious too. So I won't take up your entire day, and I do really appreciate you taking so much time out of it to chat with me. I had a really great time.
I really enjoyed it. It was really good. Thank you.
Thank you.